And welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Among weekend activities, the drama A Painted Window continues its run at the Williamston Theater this weekend, the story of two sisters who come to live together again after years of estrangement. Catch it Saturdays at 3 and 8 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. It runs through the month. The Williamston Theater, South Putnam in Williamston. Michigan State University continues efforts to address sexual assault on campus. The issue staying in the news because of Thursday's announcement of allegations of sexual assault by members of the MSU football team. Here to discuss that story and others that he's worked on recently at the Lansing City Pulse, Associate Editor Mickey Hurton.
Good morning.
Nice to see you, Mickey.
Good to be here.
We'll make some time here for some of the stories you've worked on recently at the Greater Lansing Business Monthly as well. You and I were planning to talk about the many charges against Dr. Larry Nassar and specifically what those mean for Michigan State, his longtime employer. It turns out MSU has another challenge on its hands now with these allegations of sexual assault by three members of the football team. What do you make of these latest developments?
Well, in a sense, it's probably encouraging that they seem to be taking immediate and forthright action on this. I mean, how deep it goes is really going to be an issue. Our early reporting suggests that it goes deeper on the football team than just this one staff member and these, well, and as far as the staffing goes.
One staff member has been suspended,
has been
is what
suspended,
you're referring to.
And yeah. The players have been suspended also. But it may go deeper than that. You know, we do have a new county prosecutor who has a record of dealing with sexual issues in a forthright way. Mm. So it could go deeper and the charges could be taken a little more seriously and aggressively than happened with Stuart Dunnings. We will see on that. But here's the thing that we're looking at. I mean, the university has taken immediate and forthright action in this, which some would say contrasts greatly with how they've acted in the past. I mean, these Nassar issues have sort of amplified what's been a feeling among some that the university has not taken as seriously the question of sexual assault and sexual harassment as it might have. And I mean, there's some, when you look at the suits that are facing, that are involving Nassar and that MSU is a part of, you see actions here that you really sort of, you find rather appalling. If you look at the charges that are made, and we have to understand, Mark, that these are charges and allegations mm-hmm. at this point. But you're hard-pressed to think that people, that women who say they've been assaulted would make up these charges. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that can be pleasant for anyone to relive or retell.
There was a recent battle of the op-eds in the Lansing State Journal, one from an ASMSU student leader that took Michigan State to task for the very thing that you're talking about, inadequate responses to sexual assault and harassment. Now, Jessica Norris, who runs MSU's Title IX office and who's been on Current State more than once in the past, cried foul, pointing to a number of reforms and improvements like the formation of the Office of Institutional Equity. More victims, apparently, are coming forward. Streamlined adjudication processes. Where does the dust settle on that right now? To what extent does MSU deserve any credit here for the reforms they've already made?
Well, clearly they deserve credit, but are they getting credit for things they should have done earlier before? I mean, if you read the Nassar charges, these have been, resonating in the university since, before 2000. And then you look at things, the gymnastic coach telling one of the players, oh, you better not, you have some risk by bringing these forward. You have charges or allegations, again, that attorneys had told people students wanting to bring charges forward that they should first speak to them and not speak to police. It all has a very Penn State Baylor quality to it. And the university seems to be playing catch up, each week. I mean, a new series of charges drip out and allegations.
The problem seems to be growing faster than the measures taken to address them.
Right. And some of that, you can't dismiss your history. But in retrospect, it does look as if the university hasn't taken things seriously. We've talked to people, students who have been involved in the student judiciary process, and have talked about how long it has taken the university to deal with complaints. So, for example, a woman makes a complaint about a sexual assault 3 weeks before she can even get a hearing to talk, to discuss her charge. Then another 3 or 4 weeks before she can even get some counseling. We're reporting on this story in our Wednesday, in our upcoming edition of City Pulse. And it's that sort of thing that sort of, you know, diminishes the university's long-term credibility.
We're seeing universities, not just Michigan State, get taken to task by victims of sexual assault, but also by people who are the alleged perpetrators of those assault. Men have complained that they're not getting due process. It's raised a lot of questions about due process, the way things are arranged right now. And some critics say this all belongs in the legal system, that universities are not really equipped to adjudicate these really challenging cases. Do they have a point?
Well, I think they do have a point. I mean, look, we have essentially a city here. You have, what, 48, 50,000 students, you know, 10,000 or so staff members. I mean, problems will happen. There will be instances of sexual abuse, sexual harassment. These are inevitable. And how you adjudicate some of these, it's you have to give the university the benefit of the doubt. And some that, you know, some of them are he said, she said allegations. There is no absolute truth. So it is difficult. But you have to, and that's the problem. If you want to run the university, you got to deal with this as the issue. The question really is, has the university always been aggressive in dealing with these, or has it allowed the bureaucracy to sort of handle them as bureaucratic issues? And we will get to them as we get to them. But as to the other point, yes, I mean, where you draw the line and how you allow justice to proceed on charges that are very difficult to prove. It is hard, and you can make mistakes on the other side. You can penalize, you know, those charged who may in fact be innocent. Mm-hmm. So it's hard, but the university just needs to make sure that it is very aggressive and fair and quick in dealing with these.
You were, I think the City Pulse may have been one of the first outlets to report on the John Madden situation, the texting situation, is in a different, really, league, but he took some hits over that.
Well, there you go.
That doesn't help the situation.
None of it helps the situation. It all piles on. I mean, you might see Kelly Rossman, you know, PR expert here in town. I mean, she said it was a 1 out of 12, you know, set of grievances, and it was somewhat minor. But then, nonetheless, you know, he did get his promotion to full professor, and he did get his raise. And again, it colors the university and suggests that, yes, well, we see these things, but we quickly revert to business as usual.
Mickey Hurton, associate editor for the Lansing City Pulse and a writer for the Greater Lansing Business Monthly, is our guest here on Current State on WKAR. The City Pulse has written for a while on the competition that Mayor Virge Bernero could have this year if he wants to be reelected another term as mayor. And the two names that get the lion's share of the ink here have been for a while now, State Rep Andy Shore and City Council's Judy Brown Clark. What's the scuttlebutt as we sit here today?
Well, you know, I try not to look too deeply into it, but there does seem to be a sense of ferment in the city right now. And, you know, not to you know, kill the analogy, but I mean, you know, Trump is president because of a sense of ferment. You know, Bernero's been mayor for 12 years. And he's not the easiest guy to get along with. You know, I mean, he's done some tremendous things for the city, but he also makes a lot of enemies and goes out of his way to make enemies. There is a measure of Bernero fatigue. It certainly among businesses, certainly among the sort of the civic-minded folks in the town. And all of a sudden, challengers have emerged. You know, Andy Shore is a successful politician in the region. And Judy Brown Clark is a city council member with a reasonable pedigree, that they are beginning to considering challenging Bernero for the mayor's seat is really significant, and they're real opponents. I mean, you know, Bernero has faced some rather lackadaisical candidates in the past, But we're seeing this, and it complementing this is some of the changes that are happening. You know, the people who are also seeking city council seats. You know, we had a story last week about Jim DeLine, city auditor. Now, this is not a natural politician. This guy's an accountant. But he's looking at this, and he's saying, I can really make a contribution here. I can go out and I can challenge Tina Houghton, and I can bring some real meaning and some real expertise to the city. And these kinds of things, I think they're really, you know, they represent a new level, we think, of people looking for city council. Peter Spadafore, you know, former president of the, you know, Lansing School Board. Well, this is another serious candidate, and seeing these kinds of people, in a sense, reflects this sort of a groundswell, I think, of interest in making Lansing better, and sort of saying the status quo. We don't want to see the same old gang of political operatives year after year after year, and I think that's pretty good. Now, Bernero is a very powerful mayor, and he's going to have a ton of money. And, you know, I think one is hard-pressed not to pick Bernero in a street fight, because that's where, you know, he's pretty good at that. But these are candidates who will get good support, will be able to raise money, and will probably be able to, help the city advance its mission. Because there were some serious challenges there. You know, you look at the unfunded liabilities. And I think issues like, you know, the sale of BWL, you know, will be significant issues. And Bonero's also vulnerable still on the whole McIntyre issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's still unexplained. And we had a piece the other day that it was based on a claim made against the city. And they've tried to sort of, you know, walk back as a... on that.
Just to be clear, though, I mean, Judy Brown Clark nor Andy Shore have formally declared their candidacy.
No, they haven't. We expect, we expect certainly Andy Shore to, and Clark is still considering it.
Well, Judy Brown Clark has posted on Facebook that she's holding a fundraiser. doesn't say for what, but that is coming up on the 23rd. In the less than a minute we have time left here, I'm going to ask you to summarize this. You looked into the real estate landscape in and around Lansing recently for the Greater Lansing Business Monthly. Just briefly describe what you found.
All right, here we go. Unit sales are up about 6% year over year. The volume sold is up 8%. Average prices are up. Available listings are down. The real estate market is recovering. It may not be back to where it was before the Great Recession, but I think, look, real estate represents many people's primary asset, mm-hmm. and that it's recovering, that our unemployment rate is, you know, particularly low right now. There are jobs. It's a really good indicator of people's wealth and their ability to sort of recover and feel good about what they're doing. I mean, when the house is underwater, you know, you're really stuck.
There's nothing good to feel about that.
So that was a good story. And it was sort of, we did also looked at industrial real estate, and it was pretty much the same.
His byline appears in the Greater Lansing Business Monthly, as well as the Lansing City Pulse, where he serves as associate editor as well. Mickey Hurton, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Only 6 states in the U.S. do not have a poet laureate. Michigan is one of them. After attempting to make that happen a few years ago, a group of Capital Region organizations have shifted to a smaller scale. WKAR's Jamie Paisley has more.
The Residential College in Arts and Humanities, or ARCA, Center for Poetry at MSU, began the process of trying to get statewide recognition of a Michigan poet laureate back in 2013.
I learned also at that time that there are committees established just for bills to go to die.
That's Laurie Hollinger, Assistant Director of ARCA's Center for Poetry, addressing a forum at the MICA Gallery this past weekend. And part of the pathway to creating the position of Lansing Poet Laureate came from inside ARCA.
Our director, Anita Skeen, was actually teaching a course in which she was going to be presenting various work of state poet laureates and national poet laureates. That was kind of the general theme of her course. And she thought, you know, doesn't Michigan have one? Why doesn't Michigan have one? It seemed so sad and tragic that Michigan didn't have one with all that Michigan has to offer.
Historically, Michigan has only had one official poet laureate, Edgar A. Guest, and that was only 1952 to 1959. But with the initiative to bring back a statewide laureate stalling, ARCA and the Lansing Poetry Club turned to a more local focus with help from Bob Trezise, president of LEAP, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. LEAP representative Josh Holliday.
Bob Trezise originally had the conversation with Rulaine Stokes and Lori Hollinger, who are other partners on this project. And he knows that to attract business, retain jobs, and retain talent, that we're going to need to be a world-class, sophisticated, global economy that's able to support that. And so he knew that by having a poet laureate, it helps us as a region come together to increase our sophistication and showcase that we are unique and creative and cultural environment.
LEAP is footing the bill for the first 2 years, at least, for a $2,000 per year honorarium of the new Lansing Poet Laureate, which covers Ingham, Clinton, and Eaton counties. Applying to be the Poet Laureate means submitting your work to a committee with members from the East Lansing Art Festival, Lansing Community College, and the Arts Council of Greater Lansing, amongst others. But the submission also includes a long-term proposal from the poets on how they can engage the community from the Capital Region. Again, Josh Holliday from LEAP.
So that is our opportunity for our three partners, and me in particular, who's overseeing the program, to how does this Poet Laureate take the best opportunities available in the region to capitalize and bring the literary art form to all three communities in the Tri-County.
Although as Rulaine Stokes of the Lansing Poetry Club, the third organization spearheading the Lansing Poet Laureate Initiative, tells me, it's not just the literary tradition that has a place in poetry.
There's also people who are experimenting and doing some wonderful things with multimedia forms of poetry. So I think it's all enriching. The creative mind doesn't, you know, simply stay in one particular area. It's a very, very active, very sort of exploratory form of endeavor. And so we're thrilled to see that creativity can take many forms.
More information about the search for the Lansing Poet Laureate, including the application process, which closes March 3rd, can be found online at purelansing.com/poetlaureate, while the announcement of the poet chosen will happen in mid-April. For WKAR, from the Mica Gallery in Old Town, Lansing, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Coming up on Current State, one MSU scholar has spent over a decade studying the economic impact of domestic terrorism and repression in U.S. history. Economics professor Lisa Cook says the insights into African American life have been sobering.
Their houses were destroyed. A lot of inventors financed their patenting through mortgages.
For Black History Month, I'll speak with Professor Cook. That's coming up. If you live in East Lansing, you may have been hearing a lot of chainsaws lately. The city's in the midst of a five-year tree trimming project. The Lansing Board of Water and Light's clearing branches away from power lines in hopes of avoiding the massive electric outages the region is prone to in icy and windy conditions. WKAR's Kevin Lavery has this progress report.
8 o'clock in East Lansing. The morning rhythm of school bus stops and driveway backouts is over. As the neighborhood clears out to start another workday, the tree crews come rumbling in to start theirs. It's cloudy and chilly, not the ideal weather for tying a yellow harness around the old oak tree. Still, the work needs to be done. This particular grove on Grove Street is branching out through some overhead power lines. Clad in bright yellow safety vests, Adam Spence and Clint Wiederberg gaze at the treetops like Caesar at the Rubicon. Scaling a 30 or 40 foot tree is tricky business. Some strategy is in order.
You gotta get up there, find out what you need to do, find the best tie-in point so that if you need to rope it down, you know exactly where you need to rope it. You need to clear
the clinking of carabiners soon gives way to the churning of chainsaws. The weaker, decaying branches are near the top. Some get the chainsaw. Others, in more delicate spots near the live wires, require hand trimming. As the branches fall, they're scooped up and sent to the mulcher. Thick limbs that may have once held adventurous children in days of old are quickly dispatched into tiny chips that may one day line countless garden beds. The circle of life in suburbia. This job should have been done a long time ago. By the time the now legendary Christmas ice storm paralyzed mid-Michigan in 2013, the Lansing Board of Water and Light had made the financial decision to cut back on tree trimming.
And it really came back to bite us there.
Dick Peffley is the general manager of the BWL.
The limbs were overhanging the wires, the ice got on, they brought the wires down. And there were certain areas that when we went in to do any kind of trimming, we were met with a lot of resistance, and it was just easier to back off. It wasn't the right thing to do long term, which is what the ice storm showed us.
The resistance Peffley talks about was born from a prolonged status quo. Most areas of East Lansing had not seen systematic tree trimming in 3 decades.
So you moved into your house, you've been here 30 years and nothing's happened, and all of a sudden we're coming through saying that we need to do this, and they're wondering why now. We should have been coming through every 5 years.
It took a year to clean up after the ice storm. Then the BWL launched its 5-year tree trimming program. Crews began in their largest service area, the city of Lansing. In 2016, the project got a reality check. When a windstorm swept through the region last July, the trimmed sections of Lansing suffered a less than 10% outage rate. Peffley says in East Lansing, where no trimming had yet been done, the rate topped 90%. And there was another issue. Some East Lansing customers needed some new infrastructure. Again, Dick Peffley.
The first areas we went to, their electric service wasn't even a compatible voltage with our service, so that when you had an outage, we couldn't just cross them over because the two lines weren't compatible, and their substation that was supplying them energy was built in World War II, shortly thereafter, I guess to be exact, and we said, we need to upgrade you. But unfortunately, to get there, the trees had grown up so much that, you know, we had to do a lot of removals, which we didn't want to do. You know, I'd much rather be doing minor vegetation trimming out there than taking trees down. But we had to get through this, and so far it's gone very smooth for us. We'll not say any way, shape, or form that people are happy, but they're understanding.
The Lansing Board of Water and Light is about halfway through its 5-year campaign. The utility will keep its focus on East Lansing. In the coming year, trimming is scheduled in the Fairview, Glen Cairn, and Pinecrest neighborhoods. A complete map of the project can be found at the BWL website. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. During Black History Month, we'll be exploring issues, events, and perspectives involving the Black experience. Today's segment involves a celebrated American value, innovation. For more than a decade, Michigan State University economics professor Lisa Cook has been exploring how domestic terrorism and oppression impact innovation as well as the larger economy. She studied patent data as a measure of innovation. Professor Cook says she's learned a lot, in particular about the historical impact of domestic terror on African Americans.
The first is that progress is not linear. The second is that economic growth is not linear. We think of our society as being one where innovation continues on some even path. Well, we find that it actually doesn't. There can be laws put in place, customs adopted, that would impede a very important economic activity. So that leads me to the second. If that kind of progress isn't linear, then economic growth itself may not be linear. And we know that it's not for various reasons. But one of them could be that innovation is depressed by things that might not relate to, say, intellectual property rights protection, but personal security. And we can see this now. If we are thinking about the immigration ban, there are about 17,000 students, that's the only number I've seen, who have been caught up. And most of those are STEM students. And STEM students are the ones who innovate and help increase economic growth.
What did you learn relating to African Americans in particular?
I was struck at how something that was so private, you know, you're going to apply for a patent and getting a patent, could have been affected by these things that were so public. So these laws, riots, riots and lynchings were very public. Some people attended in mass numbers, and they sent postcards about them. So that's what was really striking, that even inventors who are doing this so privately, now this is sort of the golden age of independent inventors, so they wouldn't necessarily be known to the public, that even they would be so affected by this situation.
We'll point out that we're talking here about the years from 1870 to 1940. You discover that hate-related acts depressed patenting activity among blacks by between 19 and 100%. It ground to a complete stop for some time.
That's right. And I'll give you an example of one year, and that was the year 1921. That was the year of the Tulsa race riots, or the largest race riot by many accounts in American history, and it just destroyed a community. There was a lot of property damage. Many people were killed. In such an environment, there is no way that business owners who were African American were not able to work. Their houses were destroyed. A lot of inventors financed their patenting through mortgages.
Some of the hate-related data involved lynching. What did you learn in particular about that?
One is that all lynchings are not equal. Lynchings were unevenly recorded. So all of the lynchings of Mexican Americans, of Asian Americans, of Native Americans were included with whites. So the recording was either the lynching victim was black or the lynching victim was white. And what we find is that the white lynchings have been overstated.
MSU professor of economics Lisa Cook has been our guest. We've been talking about her work studying the impact that repression, domestic terror, and the like has had on innovation and on the economy, in particular on African-American inventors in the past. Lisa Cook, thank you.
Thank you.
And for an extended version of this interview, visit our website, WKAR.org. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Stay with us all weekend long, 90.5 FM and AM 870. A reminder that some Current State segments were recorded earlier in the week. There may have been later related developments. I'm Mark Bayshore. In 2015, Michigan ended a program that gave out millions of dollars in incentives to the film industry. That's meant a change of focus for the Michigan Film and Digital Media Office. WKAR Scott Pohl talks with Film Office Commissioner Janelle Leonard about what's different these days. She says their scope has expanded.
As part of our expansion of our office, we have entered into a partnership with Google to advance computer science education. We have worked with a local community, specifically the city of Detroit, to bring productions to the area. And then the third thing is that we're partnering with local communities around the state for them to increase and enhance their creative culture through business attraction, community development, and talent retention and attraction as well.
I want you to assess the movie-making industry in Michigan these days. How has it become smaller? Is there a part of you that wishes Michigan still offered incentives?
It's different. It's going to be different because in the height of the incentive world, I mean, there were nearly 40 states that had some type of credit or grant or incentive program, Michigan being one of the most robust. So now that it's no longer available, it is much different. But it is an opportunity for us as the state to be creative about how we're getting productions here, taking the political volatility away. That honestly just sustains the industry going forward. And that's what we've been able to do with Comedy Central's Detroiters.
Old diet pills. These things are basically speed.
You think it's safe to take some of those?
I don't know.
Coffee pot! Coffee pot!
It was a production that is coming at no incentive dollars, so there's no tax dollars being involved, but we brought together public and private partners to help negotiate the cost of services so that Comedy Central could still realize the business deal of why they need to do that production here. So it ended up being over $10 million private investment for the city, again, at no cost to taxpayer dollars.
When there were incentives and we were getting big productions like the Batman movie that filmed all over Michigan, including at the Broad Art Museum on the MSU campus, there was a certain cool factor associated with productions like that coming to Michigan. Are we lacking that now?
No, we're not. There's a lot of strong independent productions that are made here, too. I mean, if you look at the independent production, It Follows, it became one of the biggest horror films of the decade, and that's a very small independent film. So, and Michigan is blessed with a very strong indigenous industry, and that's what we're trying to strengthen is the grassroots industry that is here.
We're talking with Janelle Leonard. She's commissioner of the Michigan Film and Digital Media Office. Tell me about the Computer Science First program. A year ago, there were 42 schools. Tell me about the program and has it grown in the last year?
Absolutely. So in light of no longer having incentives and us broadening our scope to include digital media, we ended up coming across a program provided by Google that is called CS First, Computer Science First. And this program is completely free. It's online, it's flexible, and it's geared toward fourth through eighth graders. One thing that we're seeing on the state level is that there are many services and many programs that are designed for high school students going into college and developing a career. But as this industry continues to grow, it's important that we're getting the attention of those students for computer science exposure early on, not just in high school, but we're actually starting in the middle school. So we're developing that passion and really giving them an opportunity to pursue computer science. So we asked Google, like, what can we do to partner with you to expand the CS First program in Michigan? They were all excited, and we have since entered that partnership. We've done an annual event at the Breslin Center that's coming up at the end of this month. It'll be February 28th, and we include different public and private partners to provide interactive stations. This year, we're going to have drones and robotics along with 3D printing, and we invite the fourth to eighth graders that are part of our partnership to be exposed to this and really engage. To date, we have we had 4,600 students involved last year. We've had 4,900 students involved this year, and we look forward to growing that.
Janelle Leonard is commissioner of the Michigan Film and Digital Media Office. Thank you.
Thank you.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, do you adjust your radio, fix your hair, eat a cheeseburger while you're driving? That would be distracted driving. WKAR's Brooke Allen takes a closer look at the growing problem on the roads coming up. It's Current State on WKAR. Thank you for joining us. A dog, a Rottweiler mix, was cruelly disfigured and abandoned, has a new nose, thanks to a team from Michigan State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. WKAR's Corel Vega sat down with one of the surgeons who performed the operation.
Barron was found roaming the streets of Detroit in January, injured and disfigured. He was missing his ears and nose. Soon after, the Michigan Humane Society stepped in to care for the dog. This week, a surgical team from Michigan State University have performed surgery on Barron to reconstruct his nose. I'm speaking with Dr. Bryden Stanley, one of the surgeons who performed surgery on Barron. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Stanley. How is Barron recovering?
Hi, Carol. It's nice to be here. Well, it's only one day post-operatively at the moment, but when I spoke to the Michigan Humane Society earlier today, he had had a wonderful night, very calm. Woke up this morning, hasn't been worried at all about his surgical incisions, and seems to be very happy.
And how did this come about? What led up to your meeting with Barron and setting up the surgery?
Well, about 2.5 weeks ago, Dr. Robert Fisher, who's the chief veterinary officer at Michigan Humane Society, called me and said that they had this cruelty case in where this dog had been severely maimed with a traumatic amputation of his nose and his ears and his tail. And would I be able to have a look at it and give some advice about reconstructing?
So reconstructing a nose, that seems like a difficult task. If you could, walk me through the surgery.
Well, we can't reconstruct the nose to restore that shiny black part of the nose. I mean, we can, but it would only be cosmetic, and so we'd have to transfer a pad. So what we want to do is to make him pain-free and functional. And so what we had to do is, first of all, remove that scar tissue because it was very thinly covered and it was so prone to getting ulcerated and damaged because dogs explore extensively with their noses. They have this great sense of smell, and so they put their noses everywhere. And the way the nose was at the moment, before the surgery, is that he would have got it quite damaged quite a lot, and he would have become very painful and head shy if we hadn't recovered it with a robust piece of skin. So we actually had to remove that scar tissue and then develop two little flaps from the side of his muzzle of really thick haired skin that could then cover that defect that we had created by removing the scar tissue.
You're an associate professor at Michigan State. How do surgeries like these, events like these, tie into your work with students?
Well, we do a lot of reconstructive surgeries, and it's valuable for the students to see in practice what they've been taught in their lectures and in their labs. And so they learn a variety of reconstructive techniques, such as tension relieving techniques and little skin flaps and big advanced skin flaps and even skin grafting. It also helps us develop and validate new technologies to see if they are worth bringing into, say, the human market as well. So, for example, human wound care.
Can you give me some examples of that?
Some of the work that we've done has validated the use of certain modalities, for example, negative pressure wound therapy on full thickness skin grafts, which has helped the human skin grafting, you know, people who need skin grafts in human, because it's validated that modality in all mammals.
So any more surgeries planned for Baron? What's next for him?
No, I think Baron is done. I think he, as long as he doesn't rub his nose or scratch himself in the next 10 to 14 days, he should heal really well without complication, and he should be continue to have life as, you know, pain-free and very functional. And he's a really nice dog, so I think he'll make a fantastic pet for somebody.
I've been speaking with Dr. Bryden Stanley, Section Chief of Surgery at Michigan State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. She performed reconstructive surgery on Baron, the dog that was found disfigured and abandoned in Detroit. Dr. Bryden, thank you for speaking with me.
You're welcome, Carol. Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. Some say distracted driving is becoming an epidemic. WKAR's Brooke Allen takes a closer look at the issue.
169.3 billion text messages are sent on a monthly basis in the United States.
It's an incomprehensible number.
That's Mark Green, the president of the Prosecuting Attorney Association of Michigan and the Tuscola County Prosecuting Attorney. Out of all those text messages sent on a monthly basis, how many were sent while someone was driving? I decided I would go out and ask perfect strangers, do you ever text and drive?
Yeah, I guess like at stoplights, like I'll think it's okay when it's a red light, but it'll turn green and I'll miss it.
I have done it in the past. I don't drive a lot here, so I don't do it much here.
Maybe change my music with my phone. I don't text, but I do to touch my phone to change the song.
Tuscola County Prosecuting Attorney Mark Green.
Driving is a very complicated task. You know, you stop and think about you're going along, you're having to perceive, look at what's coming at you, not only directly in front, but your peripheral vision, things of that sort. And if you're not focused on that particular task, that half a second can make a difference, and much less 5 seconds where you're not looking at the road and not perceiving what's in front of you.
Okay, so let's talk about the legal aspect of this. What's illegal to do in Michigan? Is it illegal to text and drive?
It is, and we've had that statute for some time, but we're at the point now, we certainly want to be working with the legislature to expand that particular area. Texting is one aspect of using a smartphone, but looking at an email, looking at Facebook, responding to an email, our present statute does not address that. So this is something that we think we need to focus upon right now. Provide more tools to law enforcement, because again, as you and I are driving around and making these observations, law enforcement officers are too, but we need to provide them with the tools to make an impact and make that traffic stop, and as a result, hopefully save a life or multiple lives.
So what happens if an officer does make a traffic stop and they suspect somebody was on their phone? What are they allowed to do?
Well, and that's always one of the issues that we have are evidentiary problems, being able to establish what was the person specifically doing at that moment in time. And you have means by which you could have consent to look at a phone and make evaluations, but then if not, you're left to other means of perhaps obtaining that information. A search warrant, some of that's fairly impractical when it comes to traffic stops and whatnot. So again, why we need to provide more tools that if you're using the phone, you know, in a manner as you're driving, obviously creating a risk, it really shouldn't matter whether you're texting or responding to an email or something of that sort.
So if you could do anything to fix this problem, what would you do?
We need to work with the legislature to provide more tools to law enforcement. We need to educate. I think it's always easy to talk about the hypothetical. And that's, you know, something when you go and talk to high school students or college students and you speak to them about, look, you understand sometimes there are no second chances. there's nothing worse than making a mistake and taking someone else's life over something that was easily preventable. But we need to continue to develop ways to get that message across. When you're young, and of course, as you look at young drivers, they're the worst drivers for a reason, because they're inexperienced. But then they're also the drivers that are engaged in the most distracted practices that there are. So that combination becomes lethal. So we have to be able to emphasize to them and have it resonate with them, this conduct can result in a life-altering event in a moment.
Tuscola County Prosecuting Attorney Mark Green says over 1,000 people were killed on Michigan roads in 2016.
Do you text and drive?
No.
Do you text and drive?
No.
No, you don't?
Never.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. Michigan is all about water. Aside from touching four of the five Great Lakes, our state has some 300 rivers. A handful of them help generate power through 13 hydroelectric plants. A Michigan State University team is using a $2.6 million federal grant to study more environmentally efficient ways to produce hydropower. They believe their work overseas could provide lessons for improving American waterways. WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports.
There's about 75,000 dams in the United States. Most of the giants like Hoover and Grand Coulee were built in the 1930s and 40s when American factories needed wattage and American folks needed work. But in the 21st century, hydroelectricity is in decline. Far more dams are being removed every year than are being built. Dr. Emilio Moran is a HANA Distinguished Professor in the Michigan State University Department of Geology. He says the social and environmental cost of dams is just getting too high.
The dams remove nutrients that normally would flow down river, and so there's less food for the fish. And there's usually a huge amount of impact on communities near dams, which are impacted by the construction, by the change in the fishery, and they tend to suffer enormous consequences.
But in many other parts of the world, dams are big business. Moran and his team are studying hydroelectric generation on the Amazon, arguably the world's largest river system. He believes there's a better way to harness the power of water.
What we are proposing is to look at new ways to produce hydropower that do not involve big dams, that may involve in-water turbines that would float in the river, attached, but you know, free-floating, and that would generate considerable power so that you can have the power without impeding the flow of nutrients and fish in the river, without having these large construction projects that impact communities, and that generates power for local communities at a price that gives them energy independence.
Michigan has about 2,500 dams. Two of them are in Lansing.
The Brinke Fish Ladder in Old Town Lansing is a popular attraction. It was built about 35 years ago to help spawning fish get around the North Lansing Dam. The Morris Park Dam is a couple of miles upstream from here. Neither one of them generates hydroelectric power anymore. But Dr. Moran believes the environmental lessons that he and his team could learn from redesigning hydropower on much larger river systems abroad might one day be applied here in the United States.
I do intend, in fact, because of this project, to start looking at Michigan and Midwestern dams, because I think we want to make sure our work is relevant in the U.S. I think, in general, the regulations in the past have been better enforced in the U.S., so that the probability of having this really bad social impact has been less than overseas, you know, in China, Vietnam, in the Mekong Delta and river, in the Amazon, the Congo. These are places which are way out there where the arm of the government doesn't reach very well and protect people. So I think maybe the impacts here have not been as severe, but the environmental costs are equally severe.
In Brazil, dam construction is moving full speed ahead. When finished, the Belo Monte Dam will be the fourth largest hydroelectric station on Earth. Moran feels the time is right for Brazil to consider free-floating turbines. And Moran says there's another benefit to dam removal. In most cases, the sediment that builds up behind dams makes an excellent fertilizer. And that, he says, could spur agriculture overseas and at home.
If we can figure out a way to technically move the sediment that builds up out from behind the dam and onto agricultural fields, this could enrich farming in Michigan, in the Midwest, and around the world with this approach.
Moran says free-floating turbines could prove more adaptable than dams and could be built to any specification. He says even a 1-megawatt turbine strategically placed in an American river could generate enough electricity to power 250 homes. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. All this week, the MSU College of Music has welcomed an Israeli jazz musician to jam with their students, and she's joined them for a small tour around Michigan schools. WKAR's Jamie Paisley has more with Anat Cohen.
From the very beginning of rehearsal with the MSU Jazz Octet, Anat Cohen is quite laid back.
Now it feels, you know, everybody feels it. It's like it has a real pocket and it feels nice. So it's okay to plan a groove when you need to groove. It's not something we usually do when we play a tune.
Yeah, I mean, there's the details and so many people are really good at actually teaching, you know, the harmonic concepts and the phrases. And we have, of course, all the records to learn from and transcribe and to learn what to play on each chord. But how to think as a human being, understanding that you're not playing with a piano or with the drums, you're playing with a musician, a person behind the piano, and everybody have their personalities, and everybody are bringing something to the table, and are the kind of acceptance we have when we communicate with another person, and how do we make them feel when we do something, and how do we make them welcome? We basically can make people shine, and we can make people be close up. So this is really a lot of things that we can do. And school environment, I mean, is an interesting one, because you want to get all the information, but you also want to remember the human side behind the music.
That humanistic approach towards music is something Anat Cohen is trying to emulate, since there is often a schism or a break between the worlds of classical music and the jazz community. But for Anat Cohen, there is no difference.
This is kind of an interesting concept because, you know, it's in a way really lack of respect. So how do you expect, you know, the public to, I mean, it's real traditionalist, and I know there's a big classical department here, but sometimes, you know, I can compare as me being a Jewish person, and with all the respect to everybody in the world, you know, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of fear in religion, for example, fear of progress and fear of the modern world, and you're afraid that you're going to lose. If people are going to know what's out there, they're going to not want to stay. They're going to want to change and bring, you know, new ideas, and the tradition is going to disappear. And it's very a jealous kind of approach.
In the world of jazz, just as with the current political climate, Anat is exhausted dealing with the issue of gender and representation.
It shouldn't be an issue anymore. This is 2017. Okay, there's a band. There's like, you know, 5 women and, you know, 7 guys, and that's it. And I'll say, oh. And, you know, I'm guilty as well, because when I see like 3 girls in a band, I'm like, oh, great, there's like women, because it's still not common. You know, women could always play music. But, you know, as far as what the newspaper accept and exactly. The recognition, that's a whole different story. And it comes with it's funny, you know, you're just watching, you know, you watch Mad Men and you're watching, you know, the environment of how women are treated in the 60s. And you're thinking, oh, wow. I mean, how do you expect, you know, media and commercials to really respect women by what they do and what they work when they're portrayed as just, you know, beautiful objects? Yeah, I mean, it's changing and...
Is it getting better?
Yeah, I would think so. Of course, you always find certain individuals that, you know, they are old-fashioned, close-minded people that they don't, not respectful, but I would assume that those people are not necessarily respectful to, not just to women, to many other, you know, parts and layers of society and the world.
Yeah. And according to Anat Cohen, what does it take to make jazz succeed?
I mean, it takes personalities and it takes a lot of courage. It's a real art. And when it's made well, it's fantastic. And when it's not made well, it's boring.
Clarinetist and saxophonist Anat Cohen was in residency this week at the MSU College of Music. More information at music.msu.edu. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that wraps this edition of Current State. Thank you for joining us. You may be aware that WKAR recently initiated a number of changes to our radio news operations. Changes aimed at strengthening local news, social media, and web efforts. In my own case, change is yielding more change. This edition of Current State will be my last here on WKAR. I'll be leaving the station soon because it's time for a change. It's been a good 10 years. Thank you for making time for us. I hope you've derived something of value from our efforts. I wish you and all my WKAR colleagues all the best. Those colleagues include Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and Jamie Paisley. Thanks also to engineer Drew Hill and to Drew Henderson for today's work. Current State's executive producer is Peter Wharf. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State here on WKAR.